Cool. Cider chat, nice apple, good look. Apple, good look. Apple, good look.
Hi, I'm Nicole Lebon from Farnham Hill Ciders in Lebanon, New Hampshire. And you're listening to Cider Chat.
And this is episode 32. I love that man's laugh. Oh, I can't get enough of it. And that is Steve Wood bringing us into this week's chat. He is the founder of Farnham Hill Cider, along with Louisa Spencer. And we'll also have Nicole Lebon and the Farnham Hill team. There'll be more on that chat in a moment. In the meantime, I have a little bit of news here and there going on in Ciderville. Just today, while I was in the car with my mom, I got the most happiest kind of Twitter notification. I looked down before we pulled out of the drive, and there was a little tweet from Tom Wark of the Cider Journal. If you don't know about the Cider Journal, you should definitely check it out. Just Google Cider Journal, and it'll come right up. He does a blog on cider, and he had contacted me saying he'd like to write about Cider Chat now that there's quite a few episodes up. Jeez, there's something falling on the floor too. Over like 31 episodes. And so we hooked up and gave him some of the answers, and away we went. And that got listed today. So that's a little bit about the behind the scenes at Cider Chat Central, if you will. And what he said on the Twitter feed was just, I loved it. I actually kind of liked it as a title, Tom, versus, you know, Rio Windcaller Chat Cider. I really enjoyed the American Premier Cider podcast. Holy smokes, my feet were shaking. I was like, that's a title that you like to share with your mom. So thank you very much for that. And then the other cool news that I want to share with you is that I am going to be at Pour the Core on June 11th. That will be held at the Brooklyn Exposition Center, I think it's fully called, in Brooklyn, New York. And what I'm excited to do is to meet all of you out in Ciderville who are going to be attending that. And I'm looking and hoping to have, well, let's do a cider meetup, where we could just kind of grab a glass and have a chat. I will have my recorder that day. I have some questions that I'm going to be asking folks to participate in. But I was also thinking, dang, well, maybe somebody out there in Brooklyn or somewhere in one of the boroughs might have an idea. Hey, Rhea, this is a good place to meet up and have some ciders. I would really, really dig that. So if you think of a good pub or a good location, I don't know, brown bagging it, I'll bring some cider, and we could just sit around and have a little bit of a chit-chat. So send me an email if you would, if you have an idea for that, Rhea@ciderchat.com, or you could direct message me on Twitter or tweet it out. Heck, we want to let folks know where the cider meetup's going to be, if it's going to happen. Although if you want to do like a little side cider chat meetup somewhere with, you know, some rare West County cider or, you know, something else kind of groovy that you got cooking away, I would really enjoy that, you know? Hey, it's all good in Ciderville. So, Pour the Core, we have America's Premier Podcast, and I do want to say that Premier Podcast status is because of you, Ciderville. I just so enjoy this. I can't tell you how much glee I get out of this experience talking to you every single week, how much fun I have editing and setting this up and just taking us down that stroll down Orchard Lane. There's just nothing better. It's just so much fun. And then on top of it, to get to sit and talk with these amazing people like yourself and cider makers, enthusiasts, dang, it's just, oh, I love it, love it, love it, love it. That's how it goes in Ciderville. You know, it's all about going up.
Going up.
Okay, and then there's one other thing I do want to share with you. I got this email as I was getting ready for Cider Chat. And when I was up in Vermont, I decided, you know, I just can't like ask folks, you know, out in the virtual world. A lot of people don't know about podcasts. A lot of folks don't know what Cider Chat is or anything, so why don't I just put flyers up? So I did. When I was up in Vermont doing my recording, in fact, this recording that we're going to be listening today with the Farnham Hill folks was on this trip, and I got this letter from James, and he saw one of my flyers at the Hunger Mountain Co-op in Montpelier, Vermont, and he writes, "As an expat Limey, I well recall my first, in quotes, horrible drunk, gasp, James, this is awful, when a couple of Italian waiters at my first summer job at Seaview, IOW, piled me with 3 or 4 pints of that scrumpy. I won't go into the outcome," he writes. Now, James is at the wee age of 73, and he says if he drank the same amount of cider, all I would want to do is spend half the night in the bathroom and develop a serious case of diabetes. Eek! Man, this is even getting worse. Thing is, cider to me now is not alcoholic, but a thriving scrumpy industry is developing. Uh-huh, it is going up. It's true, James, it's happening. But he writes, trouble is that both non and hard cider are both called cider. Mm-hmm. Isn't this what we're talking about? And it's confusing, with the exception that my cider is to be found refrigerated in the dairy section. I think alcoholic cider needs to be called something else. Well, James, I so appreciate you sending that email to me and letting me know your thoughts, because this is kind of a critical issue. It is a little bit confusing, I think, primarily in the U.S. of A., because it goes all over the map, and we're figuring out nomenclature. In fact, I talk about that in that piece with Tom Work. So what I asked James to do is, I wonder if he had thought on what non-fermented apple juice should be called and what fermented apple juice can be called. Any great ideas? How do we do this? Or do we just kind of let it ride out? You know, it's kind of like stopping the kids before they grab the cider because they're thinking that's sweet cider. In fact, that's what I call it. Non-fermented apple juice to me is sweet cider, and fermented apple juice is cider. That's in my world, but James, I'm waiting on you, and if I get the reply before this goes live, I will let Ciderville know it, or in an upcoming podcast. Alrighty, well, are you ready to head to Farnham Hill Cider? I certainly am, and this journey is going to take us up the road and into the farm, and we're going to be taking a walk with Steve Wood and Nicole LeBon to the top of the orchard at the farm. You'll see photos of where we were sitting at the show notes for episode 32 of this chat. There's a lot of material. There's going to be a part one, which you are listening to right now, and then a part two. And that will primarily be with Steve and Louisa Spencer. They are both the proprietors of Farnham Hill Cider. And if you haven't heard about Farnham Hill Cider, well, hang on to your hat. You know, this is a New England farm, and these folks have been really banging the drum for cider for many, many years. I know that Louisa has in her work, and certainly Steve Wood. I mean, the entire team has. But these two folks have been so integral to cider in the United States for many years. And I think if you are a new cider maker, or someone who's thinking about becoming a commercial cider maker, or even if you are a hobbyist or enjoying that glass right now, these are two people that we all owe a lot of credit to for helping bring it to the forefront. Now, they didn't do that with big funds or big, you know, motherships of distributors. They did it one tree at a time. And because of their work, and Steve's going to talk about this, there are so many cider orchards happening now in the U.S. Man, oh, man, oh, man, oh, I feel they deserve so much credit for the U.S. cider market. And I really hope that if you feel inspired after this chat, that you, one, ask your distributor, ask your cider bar, make sure that you get some Farnham Hill cider, and also visit Lebanon, New Hampshire. I know that many of the cider makers who come out from Cider Days who know Steve Wood have stopped in there. And I'll talk more about when the right time to do that is, when they have their growler fills and you could take home some really amazing cider. There's lots here. I'm going to get right into the chat now. So hold on to your hats if you haven't already. And let's all grab a glass and join this chat as we roll into a Farnham Hill and then take a stroll up to the top of the apple orchard there with Steve Wood and Nicole Laban.
Head south on Poverty Lane in 1.5 miles. The destination is on your right, 98 Poverty Lane.
Going up the hill, I am feeling the excitement in my body. I'm just like ecstatic, I really have to say. I've known about Farnham Hill for years. I've seen Steve Wood and Nicole Laban speaking, certainly major players in the cider scene for the U.S. for so many years. And I'm just absolutely feeling so privileged to have this opportunity to take this time today to bring us all to their part of Ciderville and share it to the outer world of Ciderville, which is what we do. A little bit of a bumpy road here just gives you that feeling of New Hampshire. It is paved, and there's squirrels crossing the road, a sign that says slow down, sharp curve, 15 miles an hour. And I do abide by that. Oh, I could see the apple trees.
And half a mile, the destination is on your right.
Already,
Poverty Lane.
Already seeing the signs. Poverty Lane, Farnham Hill Ciders. Oh, beautiful old apple trees all in a row. Absolutely stunning. Gonna find a little place to park my car, get myself out of the way, and make it all cozy,
make a U-turn and proceed to Civil Air Patrol Road.
I am not indeed going
to
do that at all. I'm going to find a good place to park my car. Oh yeah, I see it right up here. I was greeted by Corey Wilson, who took me for a stroll down the hill to one of the orchards. There you could see beautiful apple trees, many of them having three, maybe even four numbers on them, such as 62, 63, 64. Each one designates a graft, a specific graft for that tree. There is also a number of coffee mugs hanging, or I guess the folks out there working, well, what better than to just hang it on a branch on an apple tree? That morning, soon after, I was able to videotape and record and partake in the orchard tasting. This is something that the team at Farnham Hill does maybe three times, four times a week. This is where they get to taste and really delve in to a particular style of tasting that I think is worthwhile for Ciderville to really get to see. That will be part of the second series in this podcast called Part 2, so stay tuned for that. In the meantime, we're now going to head to the top of the apple orchard with Steve Wood and Nicole Laban.
I started working here in 1965 when that tree was this big around, and I was 11, right?
That was with your folks?
Not the way you picture it, but yes. I mean, it was the actual ownership and management of this farm is a little convoluted, but I was working for my father, yeah. But he was the local GP and not, you know, an apple farmer. Anyway, so I grew up working here, and then I went off to college and did various other things. But I took over, I guess while I was going to college, I took over in 1973, I took over the production of a relatively young orchard. And not planning to do this for the rest of my life, one way or another.
What were you planning to do originally?
I didn't really have a clear plan, but I mean, I went to college studying other things, and I thought about academia, and I thought about the law, I thought about a lot of stuff. but it wasn't this. I thought about hard rock mining, actually. It's pretty hard as well. But anyway, I wound up back here for family reasons. Had a really happy epiphany in the course of just trying to sort out some family difficulties with the orchard and land and whatever. And realized that this is kind of what I do. And I was trying to sell land on my family's behalf. And I started then trying to buy the part of the land that had orchard on it. And didn't have two nickels to rub together, so that took a while to actually get financing to do it. But we had a bit of a reputation for packing and shipping really good Macintosh and Corland, so after a couple of years, I was able to get financing and bought the joint.
What year was that, Steve?
1984, I bought it. And Lulu, Louisa, had been around, well, she first showed up as my girlfriend from college here in 1973 as well, so she's more or less been around the whole time as well, from a completely different world, but,
non-farming?
Yes, non-farming. Mm-hmm. But I was kind of from non-farming as well. I just grew up farming. We kind of got on with life. I mean, we got married in 87. Quite a lot of years between 1973 and 1987, but during most of which time we've been in one way or another involved with each other. But the whole kind of development of the orchard really was a... The orchard as it is now, and the cider was a collaborative between me and Lisa. It's not, meaning to say, it's not as if I got the whole thing going and then brought the bride on. Mm-hmm.
And
we were grower, packer, shippers of Macintosh in Cortland with a reputation for very high quality fruit, which back in the day, we got compensated for producing. But that really changed in the 80s. It changed for various reasons, having to do with global markets and technological developments. Max and Cortland's used to have to be packed by hand because they were so delicate, which meant there were no economies of scale in packing. If you needed to pack more, you just hired more people and, you know, put on more tables and whatever. But Rand Wayland and FMC figured out how to mechanize packing lines, and things went pretty fast. The market started insisting on really large fruit and on waxed fruit, and economies of scale really kicked in, and the premium for very high quality moderate sized fruit just disappeared, and the market just stopped distinguishing by eating quality.
Oh, look at that view. We're at the base of Farnham Hill here right now, right?
We're on it. The base of Farnham Hill is down in the valley there, and it rises up through this and above us. We're on Farnham Hill.
Okay.
And that road is Poverty Lane, hence the two names.
Right.
And so we almost quit, you know. And the really good luck, you want to sit?
Sure, let's take a seat.
The good or bad luck was that we...
this side of you, actually.
We had...
Thank you.
In the early 80s, Louise and I had occasion to go to the UK a fair bit. She had two sisters living there. I had a godson living there.
we just went over there fairly often. And we were on a day taking a random drive from the north of Wales to London, and we took the western route down through Hereford. And we drove by all these all these wild, weird orchards. And I don't know, Lulu's always said that if I get killed on the road driving, it's going to be craning my neck to see it, either a tree or some twisted piece of machinery. So, I'm looking at all these weird orchards and finally stopped to find out what the hell we were looking at. And it turned out we were in one of the main cider-growing areas of England. And by total happenstance, we were at a dinner party that night with a friend who knew Bertram Bulmer, who is the managing director of Bulmer's, the big family company that was the largest cider producer in the world, and offered me an introduction, and I took it. And so the next day I borrowed a car and drove back out to Hereford just for the hell of it, and met him, and he introduced me to his orcharding guys, and they introduced me to other growers and cider makers, and I was just fooling around. It was just an excuse to do something while we were hanging out in the UK. And so I kept going back, and I got to know the guys who ran, Ray Williams, who was the head of the Long Ashton Research Station in Bristol. I got to know,
I think I'm doing
bad?
Pretty good. No, okay. I think I'm doing well.
I got to know a lot of cider makers and cider growers in Somerset as well. And I was just fiddling around, you know. I was making an excuse for having a good time doing the stuff I'd like to do. And we, during that time, we started a bunch of grafting trials. I wondered whether we could grow any of these weird varieties here. And so this is early 80s again. We started a bunch of grafting trials, a couple hundred varieties, cider apples, and then we threw in a bunch of American and European, whatever you want to call them, antiques or heirlooms or whatever. But we were thinking about it. We had a business. We were grower, packer, shippers of McIntosh and Cortland. But we threw in all these things. With our grafting knives, we checked out just a lot of different varieties. And we found that we could grow some of them to a very high standard here. Again, we were thinking about maybe a little retail sideline. But it was during that decade that the industry we were in really, to my mind, started to collapse, or our mind started to collapse. And we really thought about quitting. And we pretty much decided that the only reason to keep going would be if we could do something that really made sense to the land.
The busy life of the apple grower.
Jesus, really?
And cider maker.
All the time.
Right.
Gotta get it. We're sitting up here on the hill with Nicole and Steve at Farnham Hill, looking down on the valley, and it is spectacular on a picture-perfect April day. Picture-perfect.
Yeah.
So you were saying.
I can't remember.
You almost quit.
You almost quit.
No. We did. We really did. I mean, we were young. We thought there are other things to do. And we didn't really. We looked at retail, and we thought, right, first of all, you don't need the land. All you need, if you've got a retail operation, really the orchard is an aesthetic adjunct to your main business, which is a store. Right, so you need enough apple trees to go to the horizon. But we're on a hill, so that's not very many.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can buy the fruit from somebody else because the fruit's not worth very much. Same thing with value added. The phrase value added bugs us. I mean, it presupposes that what you grow isn't worth anything and that you have to do something like make it into jam.
Mm.
So you're a jam maker. great, but why are you growing apples? And the we've been fiddling around with it, with the cider fruit, and the wine comparison struck us. Wine is one of the few, one of the only agricultural products I know where subtle differences between similar things are not only not penalized in the marketplace, but compensated. Nobody expects a Bordeaux, the three Bordeaux grapes, a Bordeaux-type wine grown in Bordeaux to taste like one grown in Napa or to taste like one grown in Long Island or Southwest Australia. Not only do they not penalize those differences, they pay extra for the differences. We thought that was a pretty good model. So, cider appealed. And we meanwhile had found that we could grow a lot of these inedible apples really well. And so there was really a, you know, I won't say it was a day, but it was a fairly short period when we just thought, what the hell? And so we grubbed out a whole lot of beautiful Max and Cortlands and other red delicious and golden delicious. And
on this hill here that we're looking at?
Well, this hill, it's, you know, this is New England, right?
Right.
There's another farm about a mile and a half that way. It's 7 miles by the road. There's another one about a quarter of a mile up the road. There's another one 7 miles down that way.
Huh.
But yeah, on our ground.
Okay.
You know, we had the small problem of trying to figure out how to make cider, which required, I mean, that took about a decade, but it took about a decade to figure out the fruit anyway.
So now we're talking in the 90s, right?
Yeah, we're in the 90s, yeah. The 90s, that was the decade when I spent a lot of time studying winemaking. And when we kind of got these trees producing, I mean, we planted a small, like, 1,000-tree cider orchard in 89. And I guess that was the first commercial-sized cider orchard in the U.S. or North America. It didn't strike us as a big deal so much as kind of a very goofy idea. But it was right in that period that we started to figure out that we had to do something really dramatic. And so it was during the 90s that we really started throwing fruit in the ground, and that we realized that we needed to really learn how to make something nice out of it. And we got bonded in 95 and started selling some stuff that you can't taste what you made that long ago, because even if you've got a bottle of it, it isn't what it was. But stuff that I think Nicole and I would both pretty much reject out of hand now. But
I remember those ciders, actually.
Really?
Oh, I do.
You remember Harvest Gleam?
I remember the early Farnham Hill ciders, and I was like, I have never tasted anything like this.
Well, that could mean a couple of things.
That's true. That is true.
But the really serious. I mean, given that we'd done this loony thing to begin with, the really serious epiphany was actually, I think it was just before Nicole came to work.
Yeah, because you were already doing it by the time.
We didn't really know how to taste. Then we didn't know anything about sensory analysis, but we were just tasting our stuff, and we realized we were encountering aromas and flavors from the cider we were making from this fruit that we'd never encountered in England or France. And we were trying to make, I was trying to make imitative ciders. We were trying to make kind of Somerset Devon style farm ciders. Had some ambition to make a French cider. And that really was a day when we said, why are we doing this? Why not? Why try to do something imitative? Why not try to make something delicious by our lights that reflects what we grow here, what we figured out how to grow here? And that really is, if there is a kind of Farnham Hill style, that's when it was born. And ever since then, we've just been trying to make something that we like, that we think is reflective of the ground and what we, you know, what, I mean, Lord, there are many things we could be growing that we don't even know about. We've just selected, I only tested a couple hundred varieties. There are thousands and thousands of varieties. I don't know that we've got this right, but I do know that we've got some pretty good fruit. And Nicole, very shortly after all this, came to work by complete happenstance.
Well, the reason that I ended up here in part was because we knew someone mutually who had brought some of the cider to a party I'd been to, and I had spent some time abroad in France, and I thought, oh my gosh, this is the first real cider I've had in the U.S. And then a couple months later, the friend of ours said, oh, you know, you have to talk to this guy. And so, I don't know, I suspect, were we essentially both humoring him by saying, because Steve was like, sure, you can come up, I'll show you around.
Yeah, it was a friend I'd gone to college with, but he was an acquaintance who was from Hanover, and we'd both gone to the same college.
But he was my husband's thesis advisor.
were you making any kind of fermentable product at that point?
I had been doing beer, and I had been working for White Labs yeast. So, but I was also going through that, like, oh my gosh, should I still be making booze? Am I doing anything good for the world? And so I wasn't, at the time, I actually wasn't working because I hadn't quite figured out my way out of that.
And she showed up. I mean, this guy called up and said, look, I've got this guy. I really, Nicole's husband, Greg, is a wonderful man. said, I've got this guy. I want to keep him in the math department for a couple of years. His wife is going nuts. And she did some beer thing or something. And, you know, would you mind showing her around? And, yeah, all right, whatever. You know, and I called Nicole. We had a very jolly conversation on the phone, which cheered me up a little bit about having to show this creature around. And then, you know, she met me in an orchard, as arranged, and we wandered around the orchard a bit and talked a mile a minute. And then we went down to the cider room, which is pretty much what it looks like now, although we really didn't know what we were doing. And we tasted through a bunch of stuff, and what was supposed to be a sort of a 45-minute tour turned into, what, five hours or something, you know? And at the end of which I said, you want a job? And she said, yeah. And I thereby figure I totally ruined her and her family's life, because the thing is, the course of their life has changed a great deal because of that conversation.
Yes,
but she you know, I not slowly, very, very briskly thereafter, became absolutely essential to what we're doing here. And she worked, Nicole worked in the orchards. I mean, I think he may have gotten it down there. It is kind of a one-size-fits-all place. Mm-hmm. I won't say that everybody's a brilliant mechanic or whatever, but everybody kind of does everything. Mm-hmm. So there's a sort of broad understanding by everybody of what the whole deal's about. There's nobody working in the cider room who doesn't ever work in the orchard.
Right.
Nicole more and more kind of gravitated to the cider, but partly because of just her capabilities.
Yeah, I thought I knew what I was doing because I thought, oh yeah, I know how to hook up clamps and run a pump.
Right, right.
I thought that's why Steve hired me.
Yeah,
it turns out it wasn't.
And you knew about yeast.
None of that stuff really mattered. I mean, you can teach people all that stuff, and people, I mean, the clamps and the pumps.
Right.
They're either willing to work or not, and people who come to work with something like this, who come with knowledge, in a way, I think of that as baggage. You know, I mean, we're
interesting.
I think Nicole will say what I can say, which is I learned everything I know about this stuff here. It's not that there's nothing else in life that prepared me for what we know, but it really is doing what we do that's gotten, you know, I mean, we figured out how to taste, and Nicole was 15 or whatever it was years ago, the little cluster of us who started tasting, well, three of the six of us, the others who don't work here anymore, but three of the six of us were down there today, my wife, Lulu, being the third. And then, you know, others kind of come and go. They mostly come. If they're going to go, they usually go pretty fast. But
some things have changed over time for you, you know, in terms of the span of time that you've been making cider, your techniques have definitely changed, because I do remember those early Farnham Hill ciders.
It's not techniques, though.
Okay. How would you describe it?
I think it's just
knowledge.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, our flavor profile has changed a little bit. We started realizing, I mean, Lulu is part of it because she loves the acidity so much. Huh. But we started making our ciders a little bit brighter and a little bit more acidic. Right. And, you know, found that we like them and a lot of other people liked it too. And I think we also, became a little bit less forgiving about some of the things that might have been wrong in the earlier ones.
Right.
You know, you can...
Right.
And you find this with sort of, you know, beginning cider makers all the time where, you know, they've made something and it's maybe their third go and they think it tastes great. Maybe they won't think that on their 20th go.
Yeah, and it's cool. I mean, we're not disdainful of that. It's just...
You learn.
You know, you get... I mean, what we're fairly fond of saying something that is absolutely true, which is that if our stuff is any good, and this is true of the fruit as well, and we actually arrogantly think it is pretty good... It's good in large measure because we know how little we know. We really do this. I'm not making this up. We live in a constant state of some combination of terror and wonder. We don't know what we're doing. We're constantly trying to figure this stuff out. We try stuff all the time. We're not trying to be innovative. We're just trying to figure out how these things work, where these aromas and flavors come from, how they relate to the fruit and the ground and the particular year and whatever. And, you know, we make enormous mistakes. We've made a number of enormous mistakes. But we're not confident of anything. I mean, it really is. This is true. It is true, right?
I mean, it's the whole, like, the more you learn, the more you learn that you don't know.
No, right.
You know,
right. The better you get at something, the better you understand that you know nothing.
Well, one thing I noticed, though, your palate, like, I'll go to some cideries and I'll see this, like, very scientific approach to cider making that is trying to really decipher, you know, the elements of the apple at a level that I've never seen before. And I could be wrong, but what I'm seeing here is this really taste and working with your own palate.
That's science.
It is a science.
It's way science. Thing we reject is the notion of immediately trying to figure out why something, trying to figure out causality and letting your desires, whether they're positive or negative, I mean, whether things you want or the things you don't want to find in your cider intrude on the actual tasting. We try to just, I mean, what you sat in on was a descriptive tasting. That's what we do. It's totally analytical. And there's a whole lot that extends from that that we didn't do while we were tasting down there. We know what a lot of those aromas mean. You know, we know that some of them represent problems. We know that some of them represent things that we might be able to nudge along. It's not just what's the terrible word? Hedonic.
Hedonic. Yeah.
Hedonic. We're not just going, let's make it more wonderful. You know, but it's also
like
not. You know, this is a result of, you know, all of these, you know, ethyl acetate or, you know, sulfur reduction or whatever the hell. I mean, we know about a fair bit of that stuff, but we look at that after.
Mm-hmm. So the tasting is the tasting.
The tasting
and
is
then the
tasting.
Discussion of what we tasted in the tasting is a different discussion that occurs at a different time.
Right. And so you don't say, you smell a glass and say, that smells pretty good. We need to make it smell better, because then you're lost. You don't know what the hell you're talking about. But if you say, you know, that's sulfur reduction, and that's a defect, what you miss is that reduction is responsible for all kinds of beautiful floral aromas and other things that if you just reject it out of hand, or even the sort of distant barnyard things. I mean, good example, right? You're driving through the countryside and there's this sort of friendly smell and you don't know what it is, but it's just making you feel good. Quite often in most of the Western world, what you're smelling is cow shit, right? It's like the stinky cheese thing, right? Mm-hmm, it's mm-hmm. a fecal aroma, but it's out there in mm-hmm. the distance somewhere where we can't really quite put a name on it. If you stick your nose in the manure pit or up the butt of a cow, you're smelling the same thing and it ceases to be pleasant, right? But if you name it too early, it starts dragging your thoughts in a way that you've done. And so we're just trying to, on the one hand, describe things so that we are able to talk to each other intelligently about these highly subjective things. And on the other hand, you know, not get, I mean, we are judgmental. It's not that. It's just not to act immediately because we just smelled something that tells us that this is happening and that we know that's bad. And so it's, you know, or we know that's good, so we should do more of it. We know it's bad, we should stop it. We're trying to find the elements of pleasure, and they're very complicated. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And we've been lucky in a way that we didn't know what the hell we were doing because we've just sort of stumbled into this. We stumbled into something that I think we've actually, I mean, God, we've been to a lot of tastings. I think we've gotten marginally good at it. You know? I mean,
well, certainly you're able to, like, everyone sitting at that tasting was able to just throw out so many qualifiers, not qualifiers, but descriptors that were really leading you deeper and deeper into that particular glass. Yeah. And I was very impressed.
There was a guy who worked here for a while experience. Who came up with things like, what was Brian's Easter dinner. Bubblegum, Easter dinner. Like, what? And then you think, and he'd say, then an artichoke. Like, right, what? I've got them all, you know? And we're not looking, it's not, yeah, right on the back label. And with a hint of bubblegum Easter dinner and artichoke. I mean, not happening, right? But those were highly evocative and sharply descriptive names for what he was smelling at mm-hmm, the moment, mm-hmm. and we got it. And in a way, it doesn't matter. I mean, we check ourselves fairly often, but by smelling the real things. But if Nicole says mango, it doesn't matter whether it's mango. It matters whether I understand and the others among us understand what she means by mango, because we're just trying to objectify so that we can go to work.
So right? where do you go to work then? You have this bevy of notebooks that you've taken these notes on,
yes.
with all these descriptors, a pile right, high, right.
right.
And then what do you do with that? How do you pull that out so you could actually go to work?
Well, that's a little vague. I mean,
building with Legos look, at that point.
Yeah, I mean, there's, it's like, I haven't got it in my pocket, but it's down on the desk. I've been carrying pocket notebooks for most of my life and writing down the stuff that happens during the day. I try to be as thorough as I can with this because I never know what thing I'm going to need to look at. These are the same. We've tasted the stuff you tasted with us several times before. We'll taste them again. You know, there may be a day on which we say, wait a second, what's going on with that tack? And what was it? When did we taste that? Like, you know, it would start looking to try to figure out when something good or bad started to happen, or just neutral but different, or, you know.
Like, we got one that had a little bit of reduction in it, so we'll pay attention. Like, we'll say, okay, did this happen before? Is this the first time we're seeing it?
That was the pond, that one that we were talking about, the pond, the frog and peach,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
all that stuff with all the fruit.
Right.
So you're getting this sort of slightly sticky underpinning to these nice high fruits.
And so does that, you know, are we going to get that the next three times we taste? And if we do, do we feel like it's over the edge that we like it at? And then do we consider, you know, adding copper to it to reduce it? Or do we decide that it's actually, you know, we're happy with the level of it? Or
and it's going to get blended with something else. So if we bring something that's brighter into that and thereby dilute it but keep the things we like, are the things we don't like going to grow? Are they stable? Or are they going to just kind of wander away, which quite often happens. Sometimes the things you like the best wander away, and sometimes the things you like the least wander away. And I don't know what we're
where do you go
smart.
With that, though? I mean, at some point you have to say, let's put it.
Smart.
Let's
we just stumble around, and, you know.
Ah, the randomness that Steve Wood speaks of, and what an amazing chat we are having. I can't tell you what a perfect day it was You could hear a little bit of the air stirring in the background. I have my little handheld recorder. You could see a photo of us on the show notes here. There's some more to be said here, especially as he next goes into talking about, is cider making art or not? And I'll follow up with a little side discussion I had with Steve at the end of this chat. So stay tuned for that.
You know, I mean, look at these apple trees. This is, it's not random, but it's not, we figured out how those Golden Delicious, what they want, that's different from the Macallans below them, that's different from the Wixen below them, that's different between the Calville Blanc d'Hiver below them and the Richardson Pippin and then the McIntosh. They're different. You just want, you pay attention, and you think about what you're trying to accomplish. And in the same way that we're trying to get, you see that those are fruit buds that are crowning those short shoots.
Yes.
Well, we like those. I know that those are going to produce really good fruit, those shoots with fruit buds that are crowning them. Well, try to, you know, learn how to get there to be more of those. We like peach and apricot. There are no peaches or apricots in our cider, right? But there are all these things that we think of as sort of the high fruits of the you know, kind of those kinds of sweet stone fruit or tropical things or whatever. We also like the meaty things, and we like the stinky cheese, and we like them all in balance, and we like bright acidity, and we like, you know, I mean, we like, there's tannic structure in almost everything we tasted today, except for that one golden russet, which had almost none. We are using all this stuff to try to figure out how to blend things or how to do things again differently next year to produce the things that we're trying to produce. It's not blind flying, but it's not very far from it.
At a certain point, you say, let's put this in a bottle.
Yep. That's a couple
points away from where we were. So today we're tasting the tanks. And so at some point we'll figure out which of, you know, how many of which of those tanks we want to put together, because we like the things together and we taste them together and they do more together than they did apart.
And you don't have to do a whole tank with a whole tank, obviously. There are all those barrels stacked up on the loading dock that while we clean out that are going back in. You know, it may be one barrel of that and one barrel of that and half a barrel of that and three barrels of that into a tank of this and a tank of that and half a tank of that and a third of a tank of that. And that, as we start approaching those blends, it gets really hard. First two were the differences were subtle. Big jump to the fruity one, then a big jump to the one that the, you know, brought a lot of hair salon comments that I liked. Don't know what a hair salon tastes like. And then there were two others that were very close to each other. And then the last one that had undergone malolactic was kind of an outlier. So they were kind of grouped. And for this tasting, Nicole and I kind of deliberately grouped them. Sometimes we'd scramble that stuff up. But, you know, you're just sort of thinking about, I mean, we could go down there and blend something of the things we just tasted that would not satisfy us, but that would be bloody good balanced cider. We had enough tannic structure in that. We had enough fruit. It wouldn't satisfy us, meaning we wouldn't put it in a bottle.
But from the dregs,
we do know how to put stuff like this together, and we could do a little proportionate thing of just sloshing things together. Just barely getting it.
You're saying it's experiential. I totally hear that. So that's something I think that's really good for folks out in Ciderville to hear, that, you know, it begins somewhere and it takes a lot of knowledge.
It's teachable.
It's teachable. Absolutely.
I mean, it's not, you know, it's not like it's, I mean, we do resist the notion of art, of genius in art. You know, I mean, this to us is really pretty much work. We've worked really hard to learn how to do something.
And the more work you put into it, the better you get at it. And anybody can.
And then the notion that, you know, when people say, and that's when your art comes in, we kind of go,
interesting,
we don't know what you're talking about.
All right.
Well, isn't that an interesting concept of Steve Woods not considering cider making as an art form? I want to say I did get to speak with him afterwards, and we revisited this topic. And it was at the point where I confided in him. It's not something that I talk about really freely, in that I do practice a martial art called Aikido. I have my own dojo. I've been doing that for over 30 years. I don't really think about it. It's just what I do, kind of like a farmer. It's what you do. You get up in the morning. It's part of who you are after a bit of time. And that it's a lot of hard work. And there's a certain way that your body and your mind just melds with the practice of what you're doing. And with that, in turn, it was a beautiful moment because Steve was also able to relate to that. He's practicing martial arts. His son is a martial artist too. And he knew what I was talking about and was able to see cider making in that context. So that just goes to show you, though I wanted to call this podcast episode Calling Out Steve Wood, and I kind of am right now. The thing is, the guy is a New England farmer. You know, he's been working in that soil for a long time, and you could hear that in his voice as he's kind of measuring it out. And it's part of being a farmer, and really it's also part of being a martial artist. So wouldn't you know that those two worlds kind of come together at that moment? We need to be bold in this new cider world and kind of take that stance, and I really appreciate him for doing that. And I'd also like to thank Nicole Laban for spending time with us on that day. We're going to follow up next week with the tail end of this chat and also bring you into the tasting room that we experienced at Farnham Hill. And we'll also be hearing from Louisa Spencer, who has quite a bit to say about the cider market. Really excited. A very candid chat indeed, and one that you do not want to miss. So if you have not yet subscribed to this podcast, I recommend you do. You could do that via Google Play or in iTunes. And while you're there, please leave a review and rating. Wow, so much going on in Ciderville all the time.
Going up, going up.
And if you are a patron of Cider Chat or you'd like to be a patron of Cider Chat, go to my Patreon page. There's a link at the website at ciderchat.com. Patrons of this chat will be getting some more behind-the-scenes glimpses of Farnham Hill. I'm going to be rolling out of here. Make sure to wait till the end when you can hear a little bit from Louisa Spencer. She'll give you a little insight about what you can expect in next week's chat. This is Real Wind Caller, signing off for now. I look forward to seeing you in Ciderville.
The last box we've had to get our stuff out of is the idea that cider should taste like apples, whereas nobody expects wine to taste like grapes. You know, fresh picked apples. Get out! You don't want fresh picked apples.
Just kind of giving an overview of what I'm trying to get here.
Good luck.